Okay, good morning, everybody. It is so wonderful to see everyone. Let us learn today. So we are now at the end of our four-part series that we've been learning about the process of the Pesach. This is sort of the tail end of it, and this is called the role of the rabbi. This shir is a very important shir because it's, I think, the most misunderstood of all the pieces. Or perhaps not the word is not misunderstood, but narrowly understood. Narrow is an important word when it comes to this. So first of all, I'd like to start off by thanking Paul and Yael Weinberg, who are sponsoring this morning's learning. Leah Nishmas, Mrs. Gloria Weinberg, Leah Gittel, Bas Shlomo Mordechai, Aleha Shalom. Personally, I did not have the chance to meet myself, get to know myself, but clearly has produced an incredible legacy, and which continues. Be'ezra Hashem, Paul, you should have a continued chizuk. She should have a lichtig Gan Eden. Let us learn. So, what is the rabbi? So, the story goes as follows: there were three great rabbis who happened to arrive at the same inn, and they were talking, and this question came up: what is the role of the rabbi? And this happened in the 1800s, in which Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein met with Rav Itzla Blauser or Rav Itzla Petzelberger, the chief rabbi of Petersburg, St. Petersburg, and Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Whether in fact they did meet or whether they didn't meet, they should have certainly met. And the story goes is that they describe what is the role of the rabbi. And so Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein said that the role of the rabbi is to be a poisek, is to be a person who decides halachic, complicated halachic issues, and guides the community when it comes to how to guide to live a life of Torah. Rav Itzla Petzelberger said the role of a rav is to be a lamdan, to be a person who is shakur, who is invested in learning of Torah and teaching Torah all the time. And Rav Chaim Soloveitchik said that the role of a rabbi is to be a father to all of the constituents in the town, and to sometimes even be a mother as well. And that was the conversation was had. Obviously, they were reflecting their particular roles. They were obviously reflecting the type of rabbonis that they each chose themselves. Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein, of course, was the author of the Aruch HaShulchan, predating the Mishnah Berurah. The Aruch HaShulchan and all of Halacha, even Aruch HaShulchan HaAsid, where he told you he is a formidable poisek, a poisek as a rav of a town and as an incredible halachic decisor, as opposed, let's say, to the Chavetz Chaim, who was most uniquely a Rosh Yeshiva and a poisek. The Aruch HaShulchan was a rav and a poisek, so you actually see differences in Halacha, but based on that particular position. Rav Itzla Petzelberger was a great lamdan, tremendous, tremendous lamdan. He was reflecting his own perspective as being a person invested in Torah and Torah study. And Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, where before Rav Chaim's, they replaced his tombstone. And they have all, and the new tombstone has all these beautiful accolades on it and all these things and the brisk and derech and Torah and things like that. But all he asked on the original tombstone was to be the Rav of Brisk. That was all he said. Yeah, he was the Rav of Brisk. And there's many, many stories told about Rav Chaim Soloveitchik and his particular, what he has done, what he did, and what he suffered, and what he went through on behalf of his community. So Rav Asher Weiss, when recounting the story, I once heard from him, he was here in the Five Towns, and he said, so Bahari Ashli Rav Avi Lamalach, he says, if there's a story and you hear about these three different versions of what it is meant to be a rav, he says, how could we make it to only be like one? We have to be like everybody. And so he says, that's what the rabbana says. So it's important to appreciate these are three different silos of job description, and it's important to appreciate the differences between them and what's different today as well. So let's jump straight in. But before doing that, it's important to appreciate what the rav is not. So this is important as well. So many times the rav will be asked to be a shield or a cattle prod. What I mean? So the rabbi will be pulled into something which is in the middle of an acrimonious dispute, whatever it is, whether it's business, whether it's neighborly, whether it's marital, and the rabbi is called by one party to go and either reprimand the other party, right, to be the cattle prod to fix the situation, or to defend them against an attack. And in all fairness, the rabbi has not been given the opportunity of hearing both sides. And therefore, the rabbi is thrown into the middle of a situation in which there is clearly not going to be a solution, because it will turn to a situation of shuttle negotiation. going, this one said this. So they said, you know, but there was actually X, Y, and Z. And you go back, well, they said X, Y, Z. Well, yeah, but there's A, B, C. And you go back and say, oh, well, there's actually D, E, F. And backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards. And it's not fair. It's not the way it should be. And so the Rav is not meant to be somebody's shield or somebody's cattle prod. The Rav is not meant to be a shuttle negotiator. The Rav is supposed to be, if there is a dispute when it comes to particular issues, then both parties should come and sit down and at the same time present their cases. And then they would have a little more inhibition about saying what they said about the other side and the way they said it, because they know that there's somebody else who's there to rectify the scales. And then there can be a real mediation, perhaps, if it's not too late. Usually the Rav is called in when it's too late. But at that point in time, there's the opportunity of this. So this happens all the time. Where the rabbi is called in, almost as the moral policeman in certain situations. This happens for me, I always sort of smile because this happens in kashrus all the time. Because kashrus is the perfect example of where we're called moral or rabbinic regulations and money at stake and lifestyle, which is at stake. And the two don't always fit so well together. So, like, what I sort of smile because this is an example, sort of on a bigger scale of this, where the rabbi will be called to exercise, and I apologize, this is not meant against anybody in particular, but where there's moral regulation from different arenas. So you'll have the rabbi, why aren't the rabbis closing down this situation? Because the music is not appropriate. Why are the rabbis not closing down the situation? Because there's no masking. They should take away the license for the store because there's no masks at the time when there should be masks. Now, just to clarify what's happening in those situations, is a particular element of the community wants the rabbi to represent their authority in a particular issue that matters to them. Now, in these particular two situations, or both situations which happen within a few weeks of each other, both of them are representing two fringe elements, different extremes of the community, living in the same community, and none of them would appreciate the other more regulation. Meaning, the folks who are saying the rabbis should regulate the masking are not the people who want the rabbis to regulate the music. In fact, if the rabbis were to regulate the masks, that group who want the music regulated would be up in arms and vice versa. Right? So one has to be careful that rabbi isn't simply the moral policeman for one particular issue, one interest issue, because there are multiple interest issues in a very complex community. And it becomes complicated in a situation where authority is at question in general, as to what the rabbi is even capable of doing in the situation where a community has clearly demonstrated there is no acceptance authority. Yes?
I just have a very simple question.
Yes. We haven't got into anything yet.
Because you brought up the subject, you know, my parents, you know, for a long period of time when I was shaman, they had business, they'd also that had, you know, kashrus associated, etc. Are you saying that the rabbi's authority in terms of kashrut, right, goes beyond just whether the product is kosher or
it used to.
Do they have the ability to then regulate, you know, what, like you're saying, morality?
It should, but it's no longer that way. I mean, you say it used to be that you had a city and they had, you know, a shochet and they had a little bar or whatever it is that they sold their meat and then a little makolet. And then the Rav maybe there was two Rabbonim and the two shuls would have to deal with the kashrus. So that, and that would also regulate the moral standards of the community. But there's been so much pushback that people don't want anything to do beyond that, right? So anytime a rabbi will say anything about moral regulation, then there'll be pushback. How could you insinuate, how could you say this is a free world, this is a free trade, there's a restriction of trade and all those things like that. So the realm of authority has been limited and limited and limited, which is why it's always fascinating that the rabbis then call back to extend authority into places where they were not asked to be or they were sued for being. So that's where we are today. And so, like, as an example, just last week, somebody was saying, you know, there's a new development going up on Central. And it was just passed, apparently. This is what I heard. And of course, there were no rabbis at the meeting. Right? So meaning to say, and it makes sense, meaning to say, we're disgruntled with the way state of affairs. We're disgruntled by the fact that there's a lot of people with a lot of money who are coming to this community and using it as a way as an investment rather than to try to fix the community or the betterment of the community. But where are the rabbis? Why are they not doing anything? Right? So that's sort of in that frustration. Where are the leaders? And the answer to a certain degree is, first of all, they weren't told about it. But number two is that there's been a pushback against any form of any other moral regulation. So when there is no morus, when there is no, so to speak, acceptance of authority, then it's hard to expect them to only jump to when it's my issue. That becomes the complication. But let's dig a little bit deeper. I'll come back to this in a moment. I just want it's important for me just because this happens all the time. Where are the rabbis? And a lot of times the question is when the rabbi had the opportunity to say something and nobody wants to listen. When the rabbi asked about a moral standard, nobody would want to listen. And it can't be that only in the specific issue that matters in this particular regard, the rabbi has the morals. Right? That's the piece over here. And that's become more and more evident today. So the first realm is the rabbi as the teacher, and this we'll call it the rabbi. It's the Petzelberger perspective as a person who is a teacher. And what's fascinating is the name of the greatest leader of all of in Jewish history is Moshe. But the interesting is his appellation is Rabbeinu, right? So Rabbeinu refers to his aspect of his teaching, his Rabbeinu as the Rav, as a teacher, and in fact there's a number of examples where in the Torah it's very clear. So for instance, like in Bamidbar, the parshas Bamidbar were told, "Ve'ele told us Aaron and Moshe, b'yom diber Hashem el Moshe bar Sinai." These are the generations of Aaron and Moshe. Then it goes on to list the children of Aaron. So Rashi says, well, "Why are they called told us Moshe? It should just be told us Aaron." So the Rashi explains, "Vena Mazgir Ela Bnei Aaron." Nikra told us Moshe Lefisha Limdon Torah Malamed Shekolam Malamed Ben Lechavera Torah Maale Olav Akosu Kilu Yodo. According to the Gemara in Sanhedrin, that this is like that teaching is in fact like fathering, like being a parent. We see this multiple times. The end of Moshe Ben Islaf, in Parshas Vayelech, which is all of Perek Lamed Aleph in Sefer Dvarim, the last thing that Moshe Ben is really told by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the last tzivui is Kisul Lachem Es HaShir HaZos, to write the Torah. And he wrote down 13 copies of the Torah, one for each of the tribes, one for the Mishkan. And that was his way of giving over what was the previous generation to this generation. Moshe Rabbeinu was the conveyor of teaching, the conveyor of Torah itself. He was the peal peal daber boy giving to the next generation. He was the model of what it should look like for future generations. So, as an example, one of the Moshe Rabbeinu, we would say, is the person who erected or established Torah Shebichsav. Who was the person who established Torah Shebal Peh before he gets to Rebbe? Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, who closed the Mishnah, there was Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva's five Talmidim were the ones who established the five different domains of the Torah Shebal Peh. We know about Rabbi Akiva. The Gemara in Brachos tells us, "Tana Rabbanan Pam Achas Gozra Malchus Harisha Shelo Yasku Yisrael BaTorah." It was a time when during the Hadrianic persecutions, the Romans realized that Torah, in fact, was the answer to the success of Israel. This is in Source 4. And Bob Papus Ben Yehuda, there was a fellow, a Roman Jew, who came to Rabbi Akiva. It says, "Matzal Rabbi Akiva, show you makil kilos barabim voice of the Torah." Rabbi Akiva was still teaching. Amaloi Akiva. Yeah, Tom Yisrael Ibnei Amalchus. I notice he didn't call him Rabbi Akiva. He was probably a classmate, right? And so he said, "I remember you when you were." Anyway, so, but nonetheless, so he says, "Akiva, why are you teaching Torah? You're putting yourself at threat." I'll give you an example. He sees that the fish are like staying in one particular area. He says, "Why are you fleeing?" We know that there are nets downstream. So he says, "You know what? Come ashore. There's no nets here." Like the good old days. I'm not sure if this is an evolutionary comment, right? But nonetheless, the fish answered. He says, "You're called a smart, a wily creature. We'll die outside. Of course, we can't. We'll be in abject fear." So the rabbi Kiva says, "Avanachnu." Torah is our life; it's our water. If we don't pay attention to it, we will die. We will really die. No, there's a book called just heard about this last week, which is called "What Is Water." And it was it's based on the story in the introduction about two young fish that are swimming downstream, and they pass an elderly fish, and the elderly fish says, "Good morning, young men, how's the water?" So the other ones pass and they say, "Good." And then the one fish said to the other fish, the young one said, "What's water?" And the idea that there's something which surrounds us, which we're not aware of, which is our life force, takes a little bit of time to appreciate. Rabbi Akiva is saying that to Yehuda ben Papus, is you perhaps don't realize this, but if you move out of this environment, you're dead, right? But there's a lot of things in life that we don't realize. And so Amr Loi, they said, Loi ha yomim mu'atim, it wasn't such too long. Ad shetafsul Rabbi Akiva, v'chavshua b'vayis asurim. Rabbi Akiva was imprisoned. And by the way, this was going to be his ultimate imprisonment before his death. And Papas ben Yehuda was also incarcerated. Now, we don't know if it was tax evasion. We don't know what it was, but it was something else. It wasn't because of his Torah teaching, right? Amru loy Papas mi aviach alagad. Amru loy Hashecha Rabbi Akiva shenit pasal and his pastor al divrei Torah. Oilo le Papas shenit pasal al dvarim betelim. And Papas said, "Oy, oy." He says, "I was there was other things I was involved with, which led me to this situation as well." And just to sort of deepen this, the idea is that Rabbi Akiva felt that teaching a Torah, learning a Torah, was something so part of his, it was the life force in his life. He could not stop it. He was not able to, even for a moment, he says, you know, maybe we'll take a siesta. You know, while the Hadrianic persecutions are going, what we'll do is we'll go online. You know, he didn't do that. He carried on teaching. He couldn't stop teaching. They tell a story about a rabbi. I don't remember the name of the rabbi who was teaching, and he had a particular shiur he was giving. And it turns out that it was one of the days that everything happened. There was winds, and it was cold, and there was snow and everything. By the way, folks, did you know there was snowing on Friday nights? Yeah. So anyway, so we had a basement here, so we're walking back. It was snowing. So it was snowing, and everything that could have happened, and the gale, and the polar vortex, you know, all the things that could have converged to be together. And he walks in to give the shiur, and there's two talmidim who came to the shiur. And so he gets up to the front, and he gives a shiur, fire and brimstone, like mamash, like as if there was hundreds of people in the room. And they said to him, "How do you do that? It's very hard to do that. It's very hard to imagine the energy. It's very hard to teach to a camera when there's no people in the room, right? The energy of the people." So how did you manage to find the wellsprings of energy? And he says, "I wasn't just seeing the two students; I was seeing their students and their children and their students' students. I was seeing thousands of people in front of me. That's part of the role of the
Torah."
Thank you. I was looking for Rav Shlomo Hyman of Torah Das. That's what it is. That's what it means. That's Before one element. That's the idea of this. In fact, they say that the following situation happened with Rav Kook in Yerushalayim as in Rosh Hashanah. Rav Kook was the Rav of Yerushalayim at the time. It was after 1920. And suddenly the Gabbai came to him in the middle of davening and says, "By the way, there's down the street, there's a construction going on in a Jewish house, and there are Jewish construction workers who are working on Rosh Hashanah. They're building the building on Rosh Hashanah." Now, by the way, do you notice over here that what role is the Rav being called into? The moral policeman, just out of interest, right? This happens to be the most unpleasant of situations that a person is put into, right? So we are not going to speak to them, but you should, right? That's what's being said, is we don't want to have that conversation, right? But you, as the moral policeman, should have to go out in the middle of your Rosh Hashanah davening to administer rebuke upon these proletariats. So a very unpleasant situation to be put in, and how could you not? You're the rabbi. So Rav Kook sends the Gabbai, and he says, "I'd like you to go with them and ask them if they've heard shofar on Rosh Hashanah." And he says, "If they haven't yet, please blow for them." That was Rav Kook's response. The Gabbai went, and the people were so taken that Rav Kook wanted them to be part of this so much, they all dropped their tools and came to shul. That was because he wasn't administering justice. He was teaching Torah, right? And so that care that comes with it is part of the role of the rabbi. And this expresses itself in so many different arenas. In this, we're called silo. So it's in terms of to teach, you need to actually learn, right? So like it's funny because I was saying to the chevra, we're learning Hilchos Nida on Tuesday nights as part of Smichas Chaver, and it's fantastic. And we have 19 sessions between now and Pesach, and it's a serious month. But I was explaining that you have to understand. That when we did this originally, right, in Smicha, this was a year of morning and afternoon. That's 6 hours a day for an entire year. And then a summer kollel, and then years of shimush with Rabbi Newberg, and then with Machon Puah, and then a revival. You understand? So it's nice to have six months of 1 hour a week. That's great. But you have to understand what went into this the first time around, right? And the second time around, the third time around to get here. This doesn't happen. Smicha's 4 years at the very least in YU, right? And in other places, there's not even a time frame, right? So it takes a lot of time to invest. You can't, every shiur, I would say, is a 3-to-1 ratio of the amount of time put into the amount of time given, we're called minute by minute. So a one-hour shiur is at least 3 hours of preparation, at the very least, depending on what's going on. A 10-minute shiur, you can talk about, is at least 30 minutes, usually an hour. But it requires, there's a lot of time invested in these things to do this properly. Weekly, monthly shiur, more conversations on topics that the community relate to. So scholars in residence, all the things that happen. Everybody, like, you know, people like only have complaints about scholars in residence. You know, just they were too long, too short, not enough rabbi, too much rabbi, whatever it was. But it happens to be. It took a lot of work. It took 6 months of working and fundraising and all the things to bring the Torah to the community in that way. Every single program that happens. We'll call it silo number one. Silo number two is the pastoral caregiver. That's what Reb Chaim was talking about in Brisk. So this comes also back to the Torah, where when Moshe Rabbeinu in Parshas Va'losech is so frustrated, these people are just carry on complaining, right? He one thing after the next, Va'ibin So'aron, and then they're complaining about the food and then the meat and then this, and Moshe Rabbeinu says, Hey Anochi Harisi, Ezra Amazeh, Im Anochi Eladatihu, did I give birth to this nation? Ki Toimar Elah, that you're asking me, Hashem, So'eu Bechekecho, to hold them in your bosom, Kasher Yisa Omeine Sayonek Aladama, Asher Nishbatel Avosen, is that really what is expected of me? And the answer is, yes. And therefore, if you're not able to do it yourself, Moshe Rabbeinu, I'm going to give you Shivim Zakenim. I'm going to establish another 70 Zakenim to help you, because it's important to understand that part of it is not just the teaching. Part of it is like not a father, but a mother in a certain sense, in sort of general roles, is to love them even when they're not living up to the high expectations of things. They talk about Reb Chaim, who was expressed like this, and they said that Reb Chaim's house in Brisk was open to the public, so much so there were babies born in his house. Right, people didn't have a place to give birth, and any people could come at any point in time. The stories go, I mean, these are crazy stories. They say that somebody once said that the house of Reb Chaim of Brisk was a Rishus Arabim, and his son Reb Velvel used to say that's not true at all. It's like a Rishus Arabim, their rules. You can't park here. You can't jaywalk there. He says it's a Rishus HaYachad of every individual in Brisk. Every treats it like his own. In fact, and again, you know, this the story, they don't tell this kind of story about you and me, but they say that there was a fellow who was boarding in Reb Chaim's house, and he bumped into Reb Chaim in the kitchen, and he says, tell me something. How long are you allowed to stay here? You know, like what's the tenure like of just boarding here? And Reb Chaim says, I don't know, I've been here a few years and nobody's ever said anything. So that was his, it was completely, there was no personal space whatsoever. In fact, when Rav Kook became the Rav of Yerushalayim, so if anyone has an opportunity, you should really go and visit his house. It's a very, you can actually see where he lived and how he received guests, and you can see different places he learned. It was very, very beautiful. It's very, the house of Rav Kook is a museum today. Just behind Geula, in a very upscale area, just behind the Geula area. And so when he first came to Rav Yerushalayim, people would walk in all the time, so much so that his family decided to put up a very basic innovation, which was a sheet on the door with time slots, and people would have to sign up for time slots. And they came the next day, and they found that some ruffian had taken it down. So they put it up again, and the next day it's gone again. So they said they put up a third time, they watched, and they saw that Rav Kook in the morning pulled it down. and they asked him, but this doesn't work like that. So he says the Rav has to be there for everybody who's there at a time of need. Very hard story to swallow. In fact, in his office, which is preserved as it was, you see his shtender, and his shtender is a standing shtender. Why? Because he used to learn when he was a Rav Yerushalayim. He used to learn standing between the hours of 1 and 3 in the morning, because that was the only time he had to himself to learn. And he would fall asleep if he was sitting. Right? So that's where he did a lot of his writing and his thinking. Just to appreciate what that means, the other side of the equation. This is not teaching Torah. This is simply caring for the so much pain in every community that has. I was just reading, actually, that Tzitz Eliezer of Waldenburg wrote an incredible tshuva. Usually his tshuvas are responses to halachic questions, but in the 18th volume, Tzitz Eliezer of Waldenburg was prolific. In the 18th volume in Tshuva Samach Gimel, he talks about his Rebbe, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, who, by the way, was a Talmud of Rav Kook. Just so you should, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank was in Yerushalayim. When Rav Kook came to Yerushalayim, they had a very close relationship. And this is what he says about Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, describing in such beautiful detail first of all, his unbelievable attachment to Torah. I mean, he describes the Torah that Rav Tzvi Pastor Frank would teach him before he went into an operation, right? He went into to a medical operation. And then when he came out of anesthesia, continuing the same thought. Like, you know, it's really unbelievable. Rav Tzvi Pastor Frank wrote the Tshuvas Har Tzvi. Many, many halachic applications today, and certainly the Rav of Yerushalayim for many, many Piskei Halacha. And so he says two things which really caught my attention in this regard, beyond even the Torah and the Psak, in Source 6. He says, in the left-hand column, he says, Es Rabanus ro'o ha-Ravzal, lo'i ki yetzia me'o'ela shel tola, elo ke hemshechiyus ha-yeshiva ba b'ponim chadoshos. Rav Frank didn't view entering the world as an exiting of the base midrash, but rather an extension of it. Meaning, when he dealt with the human condition, he felt that was an expression of Torah in motion. That's what you're saying about Rav Frank. Isn't that a magnificent line? That the when he dealt with the complications of real life and real people and suffering, he felt that was an extension of his learning of Torah in the base midrash. That was how he understood it. Not an interruption. He goes on further, and this is a little more terrifying, in the right-hand side, he says, "Based on Shel Rabbeinu Zal, Hoya Tamid Pasuach Lirvacha." Again, this is a phrase you hear all the time. You don't hear this about academics in university. Oh, there were such brilliant professors that their house was always open. That's not the way we describe them, right? Brilliant and how many peer-reviewed articles and how many books? That yes, and lectures and oratory. But we don't talk about this. This is uniquely Jewish when it comes to Rabbanus. He says his house was always open. Lekol darei shel kol mevakesh, davar dvar Hashem beli kol hagbala shel eis uzman. There was no limitation time. Again, something which came back to Rav Kook as well, who he was very close to. So when they said, listen, for health's sake, you need to have a rest in the afternoon. And when they're knocking on the door every 2 minutes, you can't have a rest. So you really, we should. Said when he got upset with his family for making that suggestion. Well, call your dear sefer harayas Rabbeinu Zal becher dosoi shaloi laanois v'shaloi laashos shum shoel ishmei o yishat tinoi kotinoikes haynizka bedvar alocha bedvarim ha-machridim ha-omrim b'meseches smachos. He says, whenever people were to criticize him for his policy, he would bring this following alocha b'meseches smachos. Dechesh gozru arushumim gamliel Rabbi Shmuel shiyargu. These are the two of the 10 martyrs that we talk about on Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av, when Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Shimon were killed by the Romans. So Rabbi Shmuel boiche, Rabbi Shmuel, the Kohen Gadol, was weeping. Amar Rabbi Shimon, who was the Nasi, said to him, Avreich b'shtei p'siyos ato nosun b'chelkon shel tzadikim v'ata boiche. You know where you're going, right? You know what kind of life you led. 2 steps away, you're in a Gan Eden. Why are you crying? Amar lo yani boiche al she'anu ne'aragim ko'ovdei elilim. I'm crying because this is not the worthy end of a life that we lived. This is not what we deserve because of the life we lived. Maybe you're going to rest and somebody came and asked you a sensitive question about family purity and you said, I'm just waiting until the end of my nap. And that's the Ramban's Gersa. And he says the other Gersa is Wamaloi Hashamash Yashenu, meaning not he didn't even say it, he was sleeping, but the Shamash, his representative, said he's resting. Amra Don't afflict those who are in need, or specifically the widow and the orphan. And it says Acharinu Yigodol Acharinu Katan, and the is Maxi Basrei Varagti Aschem Becharev. So he says. So Rabbi Pesach Frank says, how could I possibly turn away somebody for a shayla? Because the Torah says, if somebody's in a time of need and you turn them away, they might fall into the category of ger v'yasam, and that's a very serious thing to close the door on somebody like that. So just to understand the ethos with which he lived, this was not the Torah silo of his life, although he viewed it as an extension. This was the parent silo in his life, which was a very different and very powerful way of doing this. And this, by the way, is incredibly emotionally taxing. This is a different realm altogether, because this is relationships with everybody. This is guiding people through every aspect of life to hatch, match, and dispatch, as they say. But it's from birth to specific time periods, so like bar and bat mitzvah, to marriage, to counseling, to afterwards, to marital issues, child raising, gayrus issues, financial issues, the people who live alone, visits to people in hospital. And by the way, it's not like in the old days where the Beis HaKholim was in like a little shtot where it was like, you know, 5 minutes down the road. We're talking about, when we're talking about, you know, Lenox Hill, and we were talking about Mount Sinai, we're talking about at least an hour each direction, just for one trip. Just to understand, the Bikur HaKholim is a different surah today than it used to be. End of life issues, complicated questions, hospice issues, funerals and shiva, all the way through from the beginning to the end. This is a completely different domain of rabbi. And it's interesting to work, as we go through these different pieces, it's interesting to think about ourselves, what do we resonate more as what we think the rabbi should be? Because each of us think about the rabbi as a particular thing based on our own experiences. So everybody has their own view of what the rabbi is, but these are all pieces. The next piece is the poesek. This is what the Yechiel Mikal Epstein talked about. And we talked about this, Moshe Rabbeinu in Parshas Yisro. Moshe Rabbeinu, his father-in-law, comes, he says, welcome, welcome, welcome. He gives him his special room, bathroom en suite. And then the next morning he says, where are you going, Moshe? He says, oh, well, I'm dealing with Klal Yisro. I'm dealing with all their cases, all their situations, and I'm giving them what Hashem says. And at that point in time, his father-in-law ventured to give him some very helpful advice and says, novelty, bol, you're gonna wither, and he gives him a little bit of assistance in the whole process. But this is one of the significant roles of a Rav. As the Seder Olam Rabbah talks about this. We learned this a couple weeks ago, that by the end of the Seder Olam, when it's talking about the Tanakh of Jewish history, where the Seder Olam says, V'amad melech gibor omdoi tishaver, he says, who Alexandros mocked on? Alexander the Macedonian arrived, Shemalach Yud Beis Shana Ad Kana Yonaviem Misnamim Baruch Hakadosh Mekan Va'Elach Hat Oz Nechah Shema Divrei Chachamim. That the Nevu, as Nevu ebbed away, then entered in the realm of Chachma. Chachma means to say we don't know what to do. We don't have divine inspiration. We can't see through the lattice work. We're really living in a dark world. But what do? So the Chachamim need to spend their entire lives trying to figure out what to do and using everything they possibly can within their wherewithal to remove all biases, to be able to apply themselves to see how this Torah should apply in this particular situation, which is what we learned about in previous weeks. This comes to the realm of Psak. And this is not just about teaching, because teaching is wonderful, but this is about actually what to do, normative action, which requires an incredible amount of dearth. The Gemara actually says that in this realm, you might say, oh, well, wouldn't it be better if we had Nevi'im? It wouldn't be so nice. We could know exactly what to do. It would be so helpful. And the Gemara says in Baba Basra, Chacham Adif Minavi, that it is better to have a sage than to have a prophet. Why? What does that mean? Rav Kook has an essay in Orot where he talks about the idea of the Nevi'im giving us the general scope, the big picture of what Hashem wants. And the Chacham not dealing with the big picture, but is saying, in this particular situation, what is halacha based on the axioms and the rules? What does it apply? How do I tie my shoelaces in this situation? Details. And he says it's important to have details and structure because having the big picture doesn't lead to actual action necessarily. And so you're saying Chacham Arif Minovi means that we need the global structure, the forest, and we need the trees. And he said, by the way, at the end of time, at the time of Geula, you're going to start seeing the movement away from details and back to big picture, which is what's happening now. Right, so this idea is like, wow, we're getting caught up in the details. We need the details, and we need the big picture. That's the emergence, the convergence that we're seeing now is at the end of stage when there's Chachma and Nevuah coming together. But nonetheless, this is the requirements of Psak. I happen to have a unique situation, is that a number of Rabbonim in town actually got sued for issuing guidance when it came to kashrus, and defamation suits and all kinds of really trumped up charges, and the case was dismissed as would be obvious based on First Amendment, which is important, meaning so that clergy has the right to exercise the moral advice when it comes to particular areas that pertain to Judaism and or any religion. It's very important for anybody. And so, but in the proceedings, so one of the things that the judge said was that, you know, like, can you kind of provide sources as to, like, you know, the fact that rabbis have the opportunity right to do this? And it's everywhere, but when you think about it, it's a basic underpinning. It's a foundation stone for Judaism. But it happens to be, I put together a few things just so, you know, it's worthwhile thinking about this. So there's a number of tshuvas, like, you know, this notion of, we looked at this beforehand in many other sources, earlier sources, but in the tshuvas and the response, which is the Achronim, the Ma'arif, who is Rav Yaakov Faragji, who lived in Cairo, talks about this, and he says, the rule which we saw in earlier sources, but this happens to be in a more recent contemporary times. When do you say I need to say I follow the majority of the rabbis? Is when you're absent of having a teacher. You're absent of being in a shtot, in a place that has a posek. That So if you live in the city and you ask the Rav questions for everything else, you have to ask about this as well, even though maybe other cities are different. If there's, of course, there's grounds, if there's, even though it might be a shittas yachid, as long as it's within halacha, you have to follow that. Very important, right? That means that you can't just Google the fact that there happens to be another rabbi or somebody who's called a doctor, in Texas, who happens to have another opinion. That's not intellectually honest, right? That's not the way we operate in everything else. The Shivas Tzion, Rav Shmuel Landau, who was the son of Rav Yecheskel Landau, the Nodi Yehuda, says Sharel Pidin. He talks about a shochet in town. A shochet's not allowed to exercise. He's not allowed to operate in town unless he has shown his shchit enough and has gone through a test with the rov. He's not allowed to be involved in the town unless there is a poisek. This town is under the jurisdiction of that. Rav Moshe talks about the Vada Kashrus in Philadelphia, where there was somebody else who came into town and said that they wanted to start their own thing, and he says that that's not appropriate. It's that the rabbonim of the town have to get together and figure out what's important for this town, and if there's things that are coming in which are not appropriate, Kormili de Isra, Alayhem Ramya, you have to, that, it's their responsibility for the, we'll call it kashrus standards in the town. So there's many, many aspects. These happen to just be in kashrus, but there's many, many other elements where the rabbi is seen as a poisek. He has to do this. I personally today, disavow the term Moray D'Asra because there's an area like this, there's no one Asra. There's multiple shuls. It's not like the little village in Eastern Europe anymore. And there's no Morris either. So it's a Moray D'Asra. Two terms don't work together. But rabbi, at least the rabbi has a semblance of what it should have been in a particular, at least in a community. And this involves, shilas, all kinds of questions which are more and more complicated. So because as technology advances, questions become more complicated. The researching, all these things, some of them are open, closed book shilas, but some of them are more complex, newer issues we've never heard of beforehand. There are very, very complex questions. I'd love to share one. There's one which is actually just developing right now in the last week, which is a fascinating question, but it's not fully finished yet. I hope, God willing, will be a shear in the future. But there are so questions were never asked beforehand, never dealt with or dreamt with because of the complexity of them. And it takes hours and hours and hours of time to do this. But that also means to see things as small as, what are the standards of the locks on the kitchen door in a shul? Who has the keys to a kitchen shul? That also falls in the realm of not as teacher, not as caregiver or pastoral caregiver, but realm. When I first became rabbi of the shul, right, Talabam called me up on Erev Pesach and he says, you know, it's important that the rabbi of a shul needs to do the bedikas chametz in a shul, right? Because who else is doing it? Do you know anybody else who's doing this? The bedikas chametz in the shul? That's the rabbi, right? So I went and I was doing bedikas chametz. I appreciated that because, again, this is another sort of hidden thing that nobody really knows about. When I was going through and in the youth center in that room with all the books in the corner, I opened up the door and guess what? There were 100 bagels. 100 bagels. And then it reminded me that on Simchas Torah that year, what happened was that the tiny tata coffers just before Simchas Torah, we brought out all the food and there were no bagels. And so we took all the rolls from the Kiddush the next day. So the people the Kiddush the next day and Simchas Torah complained there was no rolls to make. We said, but there were no bagels, but there were bagels. But I will tell you the truth is that the preserving agent in those bagels was very good. They were just like they came off the shelf. A little harder, but there was no mold. So nonetheless, but that's a real situation. So Baruch Hashem, they were got rid of, and the shul was not over. The community was not over on Baal Yoro Bayamatsa. But that's because that would be a rabbi doing that. That's part of the psyche, part of the realm of, so to speak, the halachic responsibility for what goes on. How do the CCTV cameras operate? How does the sun pump work downstairs? All these things are these basic small things. How does the water fountains work? Right? How fast does the refrigerator switch on when you press the button? These are questions, and this is just in the realm of the shul. Forget beyond in terms of the this is just one building that's encompassed in this particular area, which is really important. But let's go a little further. See, things have changed a little bit. A little bit beyond this. Oh, actually, I just want to just one story, which is a very intense story. But this is a story which happened, which I think merges the last two things, and that is that Rav Moshe Feinstein was once called up with a question about abortion, a very, very difficult question. These are very, very painful questions, and he was very machmir generally speaking. And if a husband calls up and saying that he and his wife had conceived and she was pregnant, but she was suffering from depression and she couldn't handle what was going on already, and this could put her really in, you know, a psychologically life-threatening situation if they should go through the pregnancy, its early stages, and she can't handle it. And so Rav Moshe called up her psychiatrist, who happened to be Rabbi Dr. Abram Drejtursky, Zecher Tzadik Livracha as well, and he said, do you know such and such a patient? And he says, yeah, I do. And he said, you know, with the permissions to speak to her, of course, to him about her, and he says, is it true that if she were to have a child, you would be concerned about her on a psychiatric level in terms of her mental health? And Dr. Twersky said, yes, I'm concerned about her as Pikuach Nefesh. Now, you say that at the end of the conversation, right? That should be it, Pikuach Nefesh. And this is where psychiatric health is, although you're harder to pin down, but it's equal, if not more terrifying, consequences in physical health, immediate physical health. So Rav Moshe says, but let me ask you a question. Is it true that if she were not pregnant now, then truth be told, she would still have problems, she would still be suffering? So Dr. Twersky said, that's correct. So he says, well, tell me, what is the financial standing of this family? So he says, we know they get by, they're all right. He says, do you think that a contributing factor to the state of her mental health is the feeling that things are out of control and they cannot afford to have house help to be able to deal with these things? So Dr. Twersky said, that is true. That is true. They can't afford any help, and it's an incredible burden on them already with the children that they have, and that's already. So Rav Moshe says, which means to say, that it may be true that the pregnancy itself by itself could be a threatening factor, but with the absence of the pregnancy, they're already in a terrible state. Which means to say that you know and I know that the halacha is that an abortion cannot happen, but that we have to raise the money to be able to ensure that she will have house help for the next few years. Right? Do you understand what that means? Now, that's just to understand that we're not Rav Moshe Feinstein, we didn't hear all the details of the case. But to understand what that means is that the psak, which has an incredible the onus of that and the responsibility of that psak and those lives that he had to deal with, involved the previous silo, which is the carer, the caregiver as well. Right? So I understand that not every situation is the same. But part of that is the merging of all these pieces together. But now it gets more complicated because these are only three silos. And there's much more. And so what happens is that as the rabbinate hits the 21st century, there's more. So you say, what's more? So the Gemara in Moed Katan tells us in Vavamad, I was talking about community regulations. What really is important that there are community regulations. The Gemara is talking about all kinds of things. Like Metzayin and Alak Forest, the Gemara says, that all cemeteries need to be demarcated. Why? Because of Kohanim and Oichlei Truma and all, you know, so you don't want it to be that there are people in an impure area. So this is a communal responsibility to regulate where the Besak forest was. The Gemara says in the second paragraph, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Achi Yesham Zaken Otamid, Lefisha Enak Kol Bikim Adov. You need to have a person who's an expert enough how to deal with these situations. And the Gemara says, Amar Abaye, Shwamina, I learned from here, Tzurba Merabonan Deikah B'Masla. If you have a Tzurba Merabonan, this is not even a rabbi, this is a student of a rabbi, right? Somebody who's supposed to be learned. Komili demasa ale ramya. All the matters of that community fall upon them. Wow, that's a very heavy statement. Which means, say, all the issues of that community fall upon them. Remember, Rabbi Talibon was telling me one time that it was snowing and there was a 6:30 minyan on a Sunday. That's what we have, right? But guess what? Guess who had to go through the snow to be able to open up the building in order to make sure that the minyan would take place? Yeah, that's the rabbi, right? Because it has to happen. Because in case the gabbai is not going to make it, but there might be a minyan who's still coming. Kol mili demasa alai ramya, which means that as the issues emerge, then the job responsibility emerges, extends as well. So just like there was actually an issue in 2013 of Jewish Action, and the issue was talking about called the Changing Rabbinate. It was if the fall 2013. I highly recommend reading it. It's really really fascinating. To me, it was fascinating because actually it happened to be that was personally I happened to come to this shul in the fall 2013. This is my 10th year here. So in the fall 2013 was when I was coming here. And it happened to be, and I'd already been out of smicha a number of years. But it was fascinating to read this article. So there's a number of things that were said in this article, which I think that we'll call extend the parameters. So the article begins. There's a strong cup of coffee in hand. He stares at the computer screen, putting his final touches on his Shabbos drasha. He then reviews the latest building campaign spreadsheet, adds the name of an addiction specialist to a psychologist referral, calls a colleague to secure his Scotland residence for the next next month, and starts to prepare the next day's Daf Yomishir. He's got 5 minutes to catch up on the backlog of email shaylos before the 9 o'clock marriage counseling appointment. Welcome to the 2013 American Rabbit. Now, by the way, fast forward 9 years. It's 10 years. It's only getting more exciting. So with the advent of communication in the way that it's that we have it today, if you continue to read, it's just fascinating. There was a beautiful example that Rabbi Prezansky talks about. He talks about the following at the bottom of the column on the left. He says two lines in the morning. He says, one of the things I speak about is a piece of paper I constantly carry with me. He says, before a funeral, a while back, I took a piece of paper to record the eulogizers. To just get an idea, to remember ideas, that to make it much more meaningful to connect. Later that day, I was to officiate at a wedding and jotted down who would be getting to recite the Sheva Brachos. When I reached in my pocket for the Sheva Brachos list, I instead took out the paper that had the list of eulogizers. I reached into my pocket again, and there was nothing there. I turned the paper over in my hand, and there was the Sheva Brachos list. It was two sides of the same paper. We were there for our congregants with joy at their smachos and with tears at their moments of grief. The rabbi has to be 100% wherever he is. That was such a beautiful example of sort of all the multiple dimensions. I want just to give a few dimensions of what is included in that now, just to understand this. Most people say that in order to be an effective rabbi of a shul, you need to be able to be good within what we'll call the non-for-profit sector, right? Because a shul is non-for-profit. I would say that's not true. It's more than that. And most people aren't aware of this. One of the great skills is volunteer management. If you think about this for a moment, a shul is a minuscule staff, right, as opposed to a school, any other corporation. Minuscule staff. We have how many people on staff for full-time? Very few, right? But there's thousands of people who need servicing. So how does it work? Is volunteer groups, right? So we have committees, we have groups. And a lot of the groups are self-made, which are incredible because people are so good. And a lot of them require a little bit of fire underneath, right? All the different pieces that happen. How many tens of committees that are happening all the time? And a lot of them don't happen. The meetings don't happen. The minutes aren't taken. The follow-up isn't done without the rabbi doing the volunteer management, the follow-up to make sure that people are doing and showing their best, which they are able to do. But there's so many things that need to happen in that terms. Then there's the office manager as element. That's not external, but internal. Happens to be there's a lot of things that are happening. And certainly when you have like bigger shuls, when you have multiple different pieces, there are things that are going on where it's PR and what kind of tools we're using, how fast are we doing it, communication, meetings, daily meetings, weekly meetings, we'll call it models of workflow. A lot of that does come down to the rabbi as well. Technological officer. So anytime there's a new platform of technology, you will see Torah pouring into it, right? And that's because there are incredibly creative minds in this generation who are learning how to. Every time there's a new opportunity, that new opportunity becomes a forum, becomes a vehicle or medium for Torah study and teaching, right? So when WhatsApp was emerging, the WhatsApp groups of Torah emerged, right? So with any realm, when it comes to Zoom, when it comes to anything, any emerging technology, it has to be utilized and made part of the experience of learning. That's a completely different skill set as well. Now, the therapist piece of it as well comes down to the caring piece, but it's important to realize that there's the free in front of that, right? Which makes it less useful, because what that means to say is that therefore a rabbi will be called in because they don't charge by the hour, right? They don't charge by the hour, and therefore their advice is also less valued because they aren't paid for it. It would be wonderful if rabbis could bill by the hour for this, but this happens all the time, hours upon hours upon hours. I remember there was one particular situation where I was helping a particular individual and it was a order of protection, and we're coming out from the precinct at 11:30, 11:45 at night. There were other plans that night, but that was what happened. And I remember I was walking back with the lawyer and the psychologist, and I was like, ah. Really helped somebody today, and then I said, "Oh, and the lawyer and the psychologist are all going to bill by the hour." The rabbi doesn't, right? So that's part of what happens. There's the rabbis, the fundraisers. So Baruch Hashem, we have an incredible community. There's so much fundraising, but there's also elements where it takes a lot of money to float Torah. It takes a lot of money to float an institution, right? Just forget the lights, heating, and water. But there's a lot that goes into these kind of things. And there's a responsibility and a growing responsibility on the rabbi to do this. And the community ambassador piece, most people are unaware of this. But as an example, let's say when there's APAC, NORPAC, when there's town hall meetings, when there is press conferences, all these types of things, well, guess what? Guess who's going to represent us, right? Guess who's driving out an hour on a Friday afternoon to go to a press conference about anti-Semitism in Suffolk County, right? And which nobody will ever know about. But it's important because of relationships. It's important because of that. Well, that's what the rabbi has to do, is to represent, is to say that the Jewish community matters, that you say that the Jewish community cares. That's also part of it as well. And then finally is the customer service representative. This part I think I resent the most. But the piece is that it's all like the first line of combat is if the rabbi gets blamed for things they don't do, good and bad. Rabbi, it was the heating was just perfect in Shul today. Yes. Nothing to do with me. Rabbi, it was due golden shul, also had nothing to do with me. But the point is that, but those are the less serious, but they're real complaints and real issues that need to be dealt with. And Rabbi has to deal with these things in many ways. Now, you could say these all come into the previous sections, the previous three silos, but I think that it's more complex. The way I look at it is there's four main silos, which is the teacher, the pastoral carer, the organizer, and the ambassador. Organizer captures a lot of what we're talking about over here and all the different pieces of it. So you say, so what do we make of this? So the first thing we need to make of this is that this is inhumane. Right, let's okay. Nobody has enough time in the day or week to do all of this. So you just have to basically cut off certain things all the time. There's always sacrificing because you're never doing enough. But I think it is important to realize that it's not possible to be a customer service representative and a teacher at the same time, because you cannot prepare a lecture if you're getting interrupted every 2 minutes, which is a suggestion. So it has to be that you have to bifurcate or set up different we'll call it, job descriptions for workflow and work execution. As a regular doctor, a doctor cannot be sitting at the front desk scheduling and billing and be treating patients. The same thing works in the rabbinate as well, which is why it's important to set up systems which enable this to be the better way of doing things, which is why it's not always accessed. It's not always because, although we may want to think it's accessed, it's important that there's an element of this is actually a preparation time, this is a meeting time, it's not possible to have access during this time. But I think, to me, the most meaningful of all this was a lecture that was given by Rabbi Dr. Lam and the 2002 Chag HaSmicha. Every few years, it used to be every 4 years, why you would do a Chag HaSmicha, where all the graduates of Smicha for those 4 years would be now, so to speak, ordained publicly. It was a beautiful thing, really a beautiful thing. It became so much that they're only doing it every 3 years now, because in my can you remember this? There was 235 rabbis who were being ordained. If you can imagine what that means, it's unbelievable. And there were not enough seats for the parents in the auditorium that seated over 1,000 just to have this moment. So it's now done every 3 years. And Rabbi Norman Lam spoke. YU is the greatest. Reitz is the greatest producer of rabbonim in all of America, in all of the world per year. Are coming out of Reitz, are coming out of Yeshiva University, forgetting any other Yeshiva. At the Chag HaSmicha in 2002, he asked the following question. I think this is really the core of it all, and so important, so important. He said like the following. We say in davening, we quote two memories Chazal back to back. We say the following. Tana de Vere Eliyahu, in the Yeshiva of Eliyahu, they used to say, Kol Hashone Halachas B'chol Yom Muvtach Lu Lo Yishuv Ben Olam Haba. Anybody who teaches, learns halachas every day, is considered a ben olam haba, belongs to the world to come. Shenemar halichos al olamar, al tikra halichos al halachos. But a change in the wording of the pasuk. The next line that we have in davening is, Omer Rabbi Elazar, Omer Rabbi Chanina, Rabbi Elazar is the name of Rabbi Chanina, Talmidei Chachamim, Marim Shalom Ba'olam, that the sages bring peace to the world. Shenemar Makom Banaich Limudei Hashem, Rav Shalom Banaich, and so on and so forth, right? I think that Rav Sachs, you said this is where Chazal employ humor. In Mishnah. But nonetheless, so Rabbi Lam's observation was, wait a second, if the first statement is about the importance of learning halacha every day, then what should the next phrase be? It should be teaching halacha. What is this? This is Mili Dagadat. It's a beautiful thing. It's wonderful. Shalom. Peace. It's beautiful. Right? But that isn't halacha. Should you have halacha? Halacha. Cold and hard. What do you do? Right, next. That should be what the next thing is. And that was the question he asked. And he says, and he said, I just saw a beautiful article, Benjamin Samuels put this together in a tradition article last year, and he says, and Rabbi Lam looked at it and he says, you know what the pshat is? You know what's really going on? He says, it is a halacha. The requirement of a Talmud Chacham is to be marbe shalom ba'olam. That's not esoteric, which means, and I think this comes down to everything that's happening over here, is there are so many different parts of the rabbinate because the community itself is so complex. There's so many needs. There are different demographics. There are different age ranges. There's the bandwidth and the depth of a community is unimaginable. And the rabbi has to be there for all of that. But part of it is to be marib b'shalom ba'olam, is for not just the different hats worn to have a sense of unity, but for the different people in the community to have the empathy to realize there's more going on than meets the eye in their part of the community. And that to me is, I think, really the marib b'shalom ba'olam. Is if you think about this for a moment, people come in and say, there's not enough programming for youth, right? Right? There's not enough programming for young couples. There's not enough programming for retirees. There's not enough programming for empty nesters, right? Everybody says there's not enough programming, right? And so then the shul tries, right, with the very limited energy and time and money to do all these programs. We do, Baruch Hashem, now there's a retiree program on Mondays. And the youth groups are fantastic. And we had, in this room last night, we had over 50 kids and their parents learning. And then we had a Taras Mishpacha thing last night in this thing. Another 40 women came out and stayed here till 10:30 last night in this room. And that's, and nobody knows that because this group is not that group. None of those groups, right? But the point is that as the community becomes more aware of itself, and the fact that the rabbi or the leadership has to be at every one of these, then the more the community becomes empathetic to the fact that it's bigger than simply one monolithic, we'll call it slice of the pie. You know, I find it so fascinating when I'm going to drive, I'm scheduled. So when I'm on a drive, I have every drive scheduled. Today I've got an hour and a half drive, two directions for a wedding. Baruch Hashem is wonderful. Not somebody's even in the community. Somebody comes to one of our shirim. It's wonderful and there should be many, many smachos, right? But it's out to the Rockley in New Jersey, right? And so of that 1.5 hours, I have calls lined up the entire 1.5 hours there and 1.5 hours back. I'm not going to make it otherwise because there's too many calls to make, right? So, and what is fascinating is most of the time when I'm on the way to a simcha and I'm making these calls, I realize the people I'm calling have no idea which simcha I'm going to because that's not their part of the community. And that's the precise point. Talmidei Chachamim Rabbi Shalom Ba'olam means to say, in all of these ideas, whether it's the teacher or the poseik or the pastoral giver, and every one of us has a little narrow view of what the rabbi should be because of a childhood experience or a childhood mentor or things like that, it's important to be able for us to break through and have the empathy to realize that the community is bigger. There's so much more going on in a community than our unique little piece. And that straddling all those pieces together is our growth as a community because we become better through appreciating this. And I'll close the story. Is this Simchas Torah? As we're getting our call in Orem, a little 11-year-old boy, came to me off the bimah, and he said to me, Rabbi Trump, are there any Holocaust survivors in the shul? I said, absolutely. Actually, you're right behind you. And I came over and I said, let me take you. I took this little boy and I said to him, I'd like you to meet Mr. Gross. Mr. Gross was on the train which turned around from Auschwitz. I'd like you to ask him a little bit about this. And Mr. Gross and this little boy sat there for half an hour. And they sat there talking, and this boy was mesmerized. 11-year-old, fifth grader, right? Now he has, you know, never in his life. Whatever, we don't know what got into his mind. I said, that's the beauty of being in a community. It's not a little shtibble where it's just the people I hang out with, my little demographic of 32 to 35-year-olds, and that's my little group. It's much bigger than that. A Jewish community is inter-pollination, cross-pollination between age groups and interests, and being able to sit together and hear each other. And the Rav, in a certain sense, is the nexus of all those places to be able to help us hear each other because we're all richer together. That, to me, is the piece which makes it all worthwhile, is being able to, in a humane way, to be able to make all those connections, because that's what Judaism, that's what the Jewish community is about. So, Rabbi, we close the series, and this was very cathartic. Thank you so much for listening. And Bezra Hashem, looking forward to next week. I'm